Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. What's up, everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I'm joined in with a special guest joining me in from Thailand. He goes by the name Vigorous Steve. So welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for having me so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk to you about a couple topics that you already prepared. So let's get right into it.
Awesome, man. So maybe for my new listeners and those that don't really know much about you, do you want to fill them in on who you are and what your mission is?
Yeah, sure. I'm a typical bodybuilder. I've been bodybuilding for 20 years, half of the time drug-free and about half the time enhanced. So I was drug-free for 11 years. You know, I never saw the need to enhance until I reached 26, 27 years old. And then I found it was time, you know, to get my hands dirty and see what the fuss was all about, because everybody around me was already enhanced. And so I did my first cycle. And then after that, I decided, it was time to travel. So I traveled through Asia and lost all my gains, obviously, because I came off cycle and traveled through Asia and did street food and all that kind of stuff. And then after that, when I came back, I dived back into bodybuilding. And now we're here, drug-free again. Well, not exactly 100%, but off the hormones. So that's why my credibility has already disappeared, but the knowledge still remains, right? So my mission is basically, you know, I just mostly talk about my experience and my years of coaching and trying to help people and, you know, tell the audience the things that work for bodybuilding, things that don't work for bodybuilding in my experience and what I've noticed with my clients, because there's so much variety out there, but not everything works. And I mostly talk from my own experiments and, you know, try to back that up with some of the experience I have with my clients and just promote a safer health practices. Because when I started doing research, you know, we only had the bodybuilding forums. And the knowledge was just, you know, you couldn't see what people look like, right? And the results that they got from certain experiments. And there would be pretty crazy information on the forums. And I know I'm a little bit crazy sometimes also with the information that I provide, but at least I have the experience to back it up, you know, and tell people, say, hey, there's some risk involved if you decide to incorporate some of these practices, but it does work. And then pay attention to your cholesterol and this and all these markers that, you know, start to change as you get a little bit more experience in your bodybuilding journey.
Yeah, it's what I respect. I respect a lot of what you're doing right now with that, like harm reduction strategies, things like that. Yeah. That there's so many bodybuilders that are going about using PEDs without any understanding on the pharmacokinetics or pharmacodynamics.
Right. It's really difficult. And you know, the guys that end up very, very big, obviously, they're not 100% transparent about what they're doing. You know, so they'll say, they'll downplay the dosages and they forget to mention certain pharmacology that they're also incorporating. And then it's all about the training and being hardcore and, you know, disciplined and that kind of stuff. But there's more involved and they never post their blood work. So you always have to keep in the back of your head as the audience trying to learn something. This guy looks this way and this is his blood work and this is always gone. So a guy only looks this way. And I've always been 100% transparent about it. I look this way and this is my blood work. And then you can see what the effects are, you know. And my blood work was, of course, not perfect on cycle, but it was as good as it can be, considering, you know, some of the performance enhancing drugs that I ran. And now that I was diagnosed with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, being a health conscious guy, I'm like, okay, it's time to resolve that first. Learn as much about it as I can, which I learned a tremendous amount about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease over the last 5 months. And the amount of blood work and ultrasound that I got over the last 5 months from people that have the same problem, you know, is quite substantial, you know, way more than people might realize.
Let's dive into that non-alcoholic fatty liver. Like, do you want to talk about maybe, what do you think triggered it in your case?
So I still can't pinpoint it. I spent 4.5 months on liver talks, which is a special book from PubMed where they keep updating all the latest liver research, whether that's NAFLD or NASH or cirrhosis and all that stuff. So you can find a lot of information. And I think it's just a cumulative effect of the bodybuilding lifestyle combined with performance enhancing drugs. And, you know, and I was running a low dose of Accutane to keep my skin clear because I always had a little bit of acne on cycle, regardless of, you know, what diet practices I put into place. And now that I'm off hormones, my acne is pretty much gone. So, you know, I took 10 milligrams of Accutane, 3 times per week, which is incredibly low dose, enough to keep the acne at bay, but it might be linked to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And the problem is with NAFLD, acne, libido, skin rashes, that kind of stuff. There's so many compounding factors that it's very hard to pinpoint. So I think in my case, it's just the overall thing that I was doing. And I have no idea when it was actually started to occur because I saw my liver enzymes over like 10 years slowly rise, slowly rise, slowly rise. And I always wrote it off as training intensity. Because my training intensity increased and you know, performance enhancing drug increased at certain periods of time where my liver enzymes also went up. And then they would come back into range whenever I would stop training that intensely and come off the performance enhancing drugs or reduce my dose to, you know, traditional hormone replacement. So it's, you know, like as a bodybuilder, I do my blood work like almost every month, but it's not like I'm doing ultrasounds every month. So it's just something that progresses in the background. And I still have no idea what caused it. I saw that my liver enzymes increased when I went to the carnivore diet. Of course, it was carnivore on 5,000 calories. So it had a significant amount of cheese and a significant amount of butter. It's a lot of saturated fat. And basically what non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is two ways. Either you get a lot of carbohydrates into your liver and that converts into triglycerides and gets stored locally in high insulin states, which is very difficult for me considering I was doing a ketogenic diet for the last 10 years, 15 years.
Yeah.
Or fat intake where 99.99999% of the fat that you intake exits the liver, but 100% of the fat that enters, like a very small percentage, stays in the liver. And I think that's basically what happened because I saw my liver enzymes go up after the carnivore diet and stayed elevated by 20 points.
Yeah. Let's look at those liver enzymes. You mean specifically ALT, AST, what else were you looking for?
Mostly. So what I noticed is that my ferritin started getting higher and higher and higher. So I went on a diet of mostly fish. So I limited my iron intake because I'm also on, you know, a vitamin C supplementation. So I get a decent amount of iron absorption, right? So I was always at that sweet spot of like middle of the range ferritin and middle of the range iron with a solid hematocrit, even when I was running Primobolan or Boldenone or that kind of stuff that promotes red blood cell production. And then I went on a carnivore diet. My ferritin was off the scale, right? 400, 500.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very high. Within a month. And then recently, I reintroduced beef to my diet and my ferritin went up again quite significantly. So that's another marker of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Mm. Like for me, all the traditional markers like high serum triglycerides, not in my case, not in the case of most of the people that send me blood work.
Interesting.
But that's mostly like with like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is like a typical obese people disease.
Yeah. Right?
Or abusive disease. Now, performance enhancing drugs by definition are abusive unless you're doing true hormone replacement. Everything over that is basically abusive, right? Because it's not accepted in the medical field. So we do that for literally for performance enhancing and getting, you know, super physiological amounts of muscle compared to our natural potential, which I was pretty close to reaching at the age of 26. Mm. So all the literature that has been performed, it's all on obese people, people with type 2 diabetic, poor diet practices. And I had none of those. So the only thing I could tell for most of the athletes is high ferritin and high liver enzymes, because most athletes have good serum triglycerides, good fasting insulin levels, good fasting blood glucose levels, right? Although all those markers are in range. So ultrasounds every 3 years is what I would recommend everybody to do.
Mm. I think you mentioned you also ran metformin for 1,000 milligrams for how many months? 2 months or something?
Yeah, I did that at the beginning of the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease with vitamin E, so many different things. And it didn't make a dent besides my IGF-1 that went to 70 nanograms per milliliter.
With IGF-1, just out of curiosity, how often is that an important metric for bodybuilders to be screening for? How much of a role is it going to play in muscle growth?
A lot. Really? Quite a significant amount. Yeah, that's where a lot of the benefit from growth hormone comes from, because growth hormone is only active for 4 hours after administration. Mm. You can stretch that a little bit by doing subcutaneous administrations because the absorption rate is a little bit slower. But of course, the bodybuilders are going to do intramuscular injections. And because that leads to a higher IGF-1 production, right? High serum growth hormone concentrations lead to more IGF-1 production. And it's the IGF-1 that stays elevated for maybe 24 to 36 hours. Mm. And that's where the increased insulin sensitivity comes from, because IGF-1 and insulin act both on opposing their corresponding receptors, right? IGF-1 can activate the insulin receptor and insulin can activate the IGF-1 receptor to very low affinities, but it contributes, right? Over time, it contributes. So you create increased insulin sensitivity, so you don't need to produce so much insulin for the same amount of carbohydrate and nutrient uptake. And over time, that compounds in more and more muscle. And of course, you know, the IGF-1 and the growth hormone both lead to hyperplasia.
Mm. So it sounds like IGF-1 has a sparing effect on...
It has a sparing and a muscle building effect, even a sparing effect basically in a caloric deficit, because it increases insulin sensitivity. So now all the nutrients are being shuttled, including the nutrients that are coming from stored body fat, or being shuttled to metabolically active tissue and perhaps being recruited in hyperplasia, because, you know, you need the cell membranes, mostly lipids. Mm. So you need lipids from some source, especially if you restrict dietary lipid in fat intake. Mm. So it highly contributes. The problem is it also contributes to aging. So you want your IGF-1 elevated to a certain extent. And then when you start to look older than you actually are, then it might be a good time to incorporate something like metformin to bring your IGF-1 down.
So is that because IGF-1 stimulates mTOR? Is that what you mean? It stimulates
also, and it contributes to hyperplasia. So the more hyperplasia you get in your skin, you know, like you got the shortening of telomeres, and the more hyperplasia you create, the shorter your telomeres become. So if you speed up that process, you're basically directly contributing to aging, because telomere shortening is one of the pathways that aging occurs. And then you get all these defects in the skin, and some of them, you know, get destroyed because the DNA is too short. But some of them, they don't, what is it called? Senescent cells?
Yeah. Right? Did you ever explore any of the other anti-aging compounds, apart from metformin, any other, any other novel AMPK stimulators at all or anything?
No, I run astragalus root extract that has a little bit of anti-aging properties and kidney protective health. So that really lowered my cystatin C to the middle of the range over the course of years. So you really need to stay on top of it. It takes a very long time before you see a noticeable effect. And, you know, compounds like Cialis, 5 milligrams of Cialis, for example, you know, mild anti-aging properties. I think a lot of the anti-aging comes from just following good diet models. Yeah. You know, limiting your the oxidant stress. And the problem with training is, especially for bodybuilding, you create a lot of free radicals.
Well, that's what I mean with the carnivore diet. What's the, you know, we just don't know the outcomes in terms of from a longevity perspective. Like, we're lacking the flavonoids or polyphenols, which are all the anti-aging, you know. So what was your stance there?
So I did it for a month because I like to still run experiments and give it a month, you know, calendar month. So I picked the shortest month of the year, February. I don't have 3 days less of, you know, deleterious health effects. Yeah. So after I, you know, my carnivore diet was like this, a lot of beef, a lot of salmon, a lot of whole eggs, and then Parmesan cheese and butter and bone broth. Yeah. Because I was in a, you know, in a caloric surplus, I was eating 5,000 calories, and it's almost impossible to eat 5,000 calories from beef and meat sources alone, even with eggs. Mm. So I, you know, I followed all the guidelines, but I was in a caloric surplus. My total cholesterol was 400. So that's 200% out of range. My HDL was 90 something, so almost 100.
Was your cholesterol super high, even though you're using a range of supplements as well? Taurine and stuff?
Citrus, bergamot, taurine, you know, fish oil at each meal, and I'm performing daily cardio. And my cholesterol is never horrible on cycle. Even when I run a significant amount of anabolics, my cholesterol is still in range. And my HDL is like 50. And my LDL is 110, 120. Yeah. Because I take, you know, all the precautions needed to keep my lipids in range. And I took all the precautions on carnivore, and it was the worst my lipids were ever... I've ever seen. My HDL was high, 93. That's good. But my LDL was 270. So that's a lot of potential for foam cells.
Do you think it was mostly mediated via the reduction in fiber specifically or fiber?
That also. Yeah. The first 2 weeks I didn't have any fiber. And then I saw my liver enzymes go up. I'm like, this can't be good. And you know, going to the bathroom was literally like a hippopotamus. It was really? It was disgusting.
Yeah.
Right? And then I took the cheese and the butter out for a while. It was still the same. So I got the same digestion with the beef and the... So I added in chia seeds. So I called it 95% carnivore because 5% of my calories came from chia seeds. And that actually kept my stool a little bit more solid. But before that, it was horrible, man.
But it's, with the carnivore diet, I know a lot, and I personally played around with it. My digestion's amazing. Not my stools, but like there's no bloating, there's no cramping. Do you find that as well?
That was absolutely amazing. I could pull deep vacuums, and I did a little bit of raw food in between, so that improves digestion even further because you're not cooking all the, you know, the beneficial enzymes which are present in all, you know, food sources. Mm. So I did a little bit of raw food, and my digestion was absolutely phenomenal, really, until I went to the bathroom, and then it was an experience. Right? But... You know, comparing the carnivore diet when it comes to digestion to eating all raw food, I think eating all raw food is way better.
Yeah.
With vegetables and with, you know, soaked almonds and you know, all the stuff the hippies do. Really? It was a lot better. Then my digestion then was a lot better. So I think, you know, there's like all these extreme diets, and even the ketogenic diet is a little bit extreme because you're limiting carbohydrate intake. I think all these extreme diets, I don't think that they're sustainable. Now, whether that's the vegan diet or carnivore diet or ketogenic diets. With ketogenic diets, if you do that for prolonged periods of time, you get some glucose resistance. Right? Because you're not stimulating these glucose transporters anymore. And there's many of them in the body besides the GLUT4. Mm. There's many glucose uptake transporters that are present in the body. And you can stimulate some of them with vitamin C. But you can't stimulate all of them. So you still need to have some sort of carbohydrate intake. And 50 grams from, you know, oatmeal or fruit or whatever is a good source. But, you know, I was doing fruit pre-workout or post-workout. But then there's something to say for the fructose and the fat intake contributing to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So you do the best with the information you have. But I think a varied approach, you know, is probably the most sustainable.
Yeah, I think there's definitely still a time and place for the carnivore diet, but it's just, like you said, short term, maybe to correct some digestive issues.
That's the only case I would recommend it. So maybe a month, you know, you do a carnivore diet, but you still have some fiber. Because, I mean, everybody can tolerate chia seeds. you know, or a little bit of vegetables. Like, and the weird thing is, like, for the last 4 weeks, I've only been eating vegetables besides my, my one cheat meal on Sunday because I still have a relationship and I still like to go out to eat. So I've been eating like vegetarian for 6.5 days a week.
Oh, man.
My digestion is just as good.
Really?
Just as good.
No, your stools must be going like twice a day now.
Yeah, no, it's best stools ever, you know, 2 wipes and you're done, you know, because it's so much fiber. That's the best. Yeah, we're going into details now, but that's probably the what you want, right? Like with the carnivore diet, it was a gigantic mess. I had to clean the toilet every time, you know, like a full clean. So I go by the entire thing, experience of whether your digestion is good. You know, I have no acid reflux, no bloating, no gas, and the bathroom is, you know, clean. So yeah, you have to look at all aspects.
What do you think would have happened with your testosterone levels? Do you think you would have seen a rise in SHBG because you've dropped the carbohydrate? Like, what do you think would have happened?
Well, now, you mean on the carnivore or now?
Yeah, carnivore diet.
Man, where was my acid? But I was also on hormone replacement for bodybuilders. So it's a little bit more generous. You know, I was still training heavy. So I was running 250 milligrams of testosterone per week. Mm-hmm. I think my SHBG was somewhere in the middle of the range, 25 nanomoles per liter. Now I keep my estrogen a little bit higher than most people, saying that contributes to sexual binding globulin. So my sex drive was great. My anabolism was good because some of the sex drive and anabolism actually goes to the sexual binding globulin because there's a receptor complex that actually takes the sexual binding globulin and allows testosterone to enter the cell. So besides membrane androgen receptors and nuclear androgen receptors, you have the sexual binding globulin receptor, which takes the sex hormones. So it's, people always say, it's inactive when it's in a SHBG, but that's not true. It's inactive when it's in albumin.
Isn't that ironic?
So this is the foreign bullshit nonsense.
Yeah, everyone's trying to
throw Proviron at it.
Everyone's trying to suppress SHBG. Meanwhile, mine is through the roof, like almost off the scale, alongside estrogen and testosterone. Like everything. Yeah. That's how it should be, right? You'd rather
if you're trying to biohack and optimize your scenario, you try to bring everything to the top of the reference range. And SHBG can be somewhere in the middle because the more testosterone or anabolics you take, the lower it's going to be. It's inevitable. Wow. Same as your HDL. The more anabolics you take, the lower it's going to be. It doesn't matter what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you throw the selective estrogen receptor modulators at it, it will never be in the range again. But it can be as close to the range as it possibly can. Mm-hmm. But the lower your sexual binding globulin goes, the less anabolism you get because you get some of this testosterone and other androgen delivery through the sexual binding globulin receptor complex. But your sex drive will go down. So people take Proviron and their sex drive goes up because their free testosterone goes up. And then their sex drive goes away because now their sexual binding globulin is so low that they're missing out on some of this testosterone or DHT or estrogen delivery. Because, you know, the postman is on vacation.
Yeah. So this Proviron, explain to my listeners what that is because they won't know anything about that.
All right. So Proviron is a DHT derivative. You have testosterone. It converts into dehydrotestosterone. And, you know, in the quest to find more selective compounds, they developed DHT derivatives. It's one of the groups of the testosterone derivatives. And then they developed Proviron and they found out that it has the highest binding affinity for the sexual hormone binding globulin. So it binds and it basically acts as a suicide aromatase inhibitor where aromatin attaches to the aromatase enzyme and it becomes inactive. And Proviron almost does the same thing because it has such a high binding affinity for the sexual hormone binding globulin, it stays in there for a very long time. And now testosterone is only able to bind to albumin. Because all the sexual hormone binding globulin is bound with Proviron. So now you have a lot of free testosterone. And as time goes on and sexual hormone binding globulin starts to deliver Proviron to tissue, the Proviron is taking the place of testosterone regarding androgen-mediated anabolism or collagen synthesis and that kind of stuff. So you're missing out on part of the pathway that testosterone can induce. Mm. Including the sex drive one, because Proviron by itself, it doesn't do anything. It has one function, just like aromatin. Aromatin blocks the aromatase enzyme, and Proviron blocks the sexual binding globulin. Mm. And then over time, it will come down because prevagrin can also enter the aromatized enzyme and block the conversion of testosterone into estrogen. So now estrogen goes down, sexual binding globulin goes down even further, your HDL will go down, and goodbye sex drive. You know, so it's a temporary thing. I only recommend prevagrin maybe the first 4 weeks. So let's say you wanted to go on cycle and your sexual binding globulin is, let's say, 100, like mine is 120 right now after this this vegetable only diet. It's off the roof. It's twice as high as it should be. But it, you know, it's a temporary state. I don't mind because I know I'm going to get a lot of androgen delivery by the time I get back with my bodybuilding journey. So I will literally explode because the sexual binding globulin is so high. So let's say in your case, your sex drive is not so good. Your sexual binding globulin is high. You go on cycle and you want to speed up the process. 25 milligrams of prevagrin, maybe 2 to 4 weeks. Sexual binding globulin is in the middle of the range. Your sex drive is good. Your free testosterone is high. Then you discontinue it.
Right.
But all the guys, they now get a positive association with prevagrin and sex drive and they continue.
Too far.
They overshoot. Exactly. They overshoot. Now the sex drive is gone. I'm going to take more prevagrin. Yeah. And then they contact me and they, you know, Steve, my sex drive is horrible. What do I do? So I'll take the prevagrin out.
let's talk more about the roles and the functions of estrogen in men. Because I know a lot of people, again, the bro science mentality, let's just...
Estrogen phobia is off the roof right now.
Yeah, like talk about...
But androgen phobia is also off the roof. So you have estrogen phobia amongst men and androgen phobia amongst women. PCR. That's why everybody's single is nowadays. It's so you like both men and women both have sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, and everything in between, right? My wife has reasonably high testosterone concentrations for a woman. They're always out of the top of the reference range. That's why she's such a good athlete. And for men, if you bring your testosterone over the reference range and you bring your estrogen under the reference range, your ratio is completely messed up. So your test need, if your testosterone goes up, your estrogen needs to come up also because it's the testosterone and the androgens that skew the ratio between HDL and LDL. So your LDL goes up, LDL goes up and HDL goes down. And the estrogen is actually able to prevent some of that because estrogen brings the HDL up and the LDL down. And they have a little bit of an opposing effect. Same as that androgens are neurotoxic and estrogen is neuroprotective. So androgens up, estrogen down, poor lipids, poor neuroprotection. Now, how that compares to alcohol abuse, I have no idea. That has never been directly studied. But there's, you know, if you look to some of the pro bodybuilders that were known to abuse androgens, they're not very cognitive. You know, and whether that comes from the estrogen reduction or the high androgens, we're not really sure.
So what's the link there with the estrogen modulating cholesterol? Is that because estrogen's impacting like PPAR alpha, like in the liver? Like what's
that? That I'm not sure. I believe that it activates something in the liver where it promotes HDL formation, and whether that is indirectly from some sort of cholesterol synthesis. Right? Because HDL and LDL both deliver cholesterol and lipids from and to tissue. I'm not exactly sure. I know that Novodex or selective estrogen receptor modulators can actually promote HDL and reduce LDL also. Yeah. Okay.
Interesting. Now, the context of SERMs, let's talk about clomiphene and clomiphene, some of these compounds. You want to explain what they are and how you'd best deploy them?
So there are several scenarios in where you can employ selective estrogen receptor modulators. So I'm sure everybody's familiar by now with the term selective androgen receptor modulators, but it's a little bit misleading because they don't selectively activate or block estrogen receptors or androgen receptors in specific tissue. Like it would be perfect if a SARM would activate the androgen receptor in skeletal muscle and block it in the pituitary. You would get no HPTA suppression. You would not shut down. You would still produce luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, and your testosterone production would never be downregulated. Right? That would be perfect. Unfortunately, that's not the case. They activate the androgen receptor to a certain extent in all tissues, so you'd still get pituitary shutdown and your testosterone goes with it. But selective estrogen receptor modulators, depending on which one you take, they activate the estrogen receptor in certain tissue, the estrogen alpha and beta, with different affinities. and they block it in other tissue. So they can block it in the hypothalamic and the pituitary in the brain, and they can activate it in the liver, causing estrogen-like effects. They block it in adipose tissue, in the lower body, in the and the chest, and they activate it in the uterus, for example. And then, you know, clomiphene, I think, blocks it in the uterus, and Novodex activates it. And I'm sure I'm mistaken a little bit because, you know, that's not my expertise about estrogen biting in the uterus, you know, considering that I'm a bodybuilder coach for men mostly. But they act agonistic and antagonistic depending on which tissues that they bind to. Mm. So in most cases, bodybuilders use them in the recovery of their hypothalamic pituitary testes axis during post-cycle therapy because right. they're able to block the estrogen receptors in the hypothalamic and the pituitary, allowing for normal luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone over time. Because they, you know, there's a negative feedback of estrogen on the hypothalamic pituitary testes axis. And of course, in those situations, testosterone is low, progesterone is going to be low if you PCT correctly. You don't let the trenbolone and the nandrolone clear from your system. You're still antagonizing the progesterone receptor. Mm. So you don't PCT correctly that way. But by blocking the estrogen receptor in the brain, you allow luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone slowly to come up over time. That's why we take that 4 weeks, maybe even 6 weeks. Sometimes people need to take it for a year during post-cycle therapy. Mm. Another way is to block the estrogen receptors in breast tissue so you don't get gynecomastia when your estrogen, prolactin, or progesterone levels are too high. Mm. Another way is to fix your lipids. It's a quick fix. You know, let's say your HDL and LDL is horrible. You use tamoxifen to bring those back into range. It's a quick fix for most bodybuilders. Works within 2 weeks.
Wow.
That's what I did after the carnivore diet. And within 2 weeks, my lipids were much, much better.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So let's talk about one of the most abused steroids, trenbolone.
Yeah.
I think you have a story about trenbolone you'd like to share.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was doing my research on the bodybuilding forums, and everybody is praising trenbolone like it's the best compound ever. And yes, for muscle building, it's indeed the most sustainable compound you can take compared to all the other compounds we can take. On a milligram for milligram, it will yield the best results. Giving the best results, it will also come with a laundry list of side effects. And those side effects for most people are intolerable. So it's, you know, the mood changes and the anger management that I experienced on trenbolone was already not worth it. And you have night sweats and your body odor starts to smell differently, you know, because it's so androgenic and it alters metabolism to such an extent you get weird body odor or your weird dreams by antagonizing the androgen receptors in the brain and the progesterone receptors at the same time because it's a 19-NOR derivative. So it also activates a progesterone receptor and then it can increase prolactin concentrations, causing gynecomastia downstream. So trenbolone is a huge trade-off drug. And the only situation where it's warranted is a contest. Mm. When you do a bodybuilding contest, and it, of course on the boards they never say, no, just take high trend, low test, and you'll start to look like a pro bodybuilder, you know, we'll change your genetics, that kind of stuff. So after 10 years of experience, I realized, you know what, if you want to use trend, yes, there's one scenario where it's warranted, and that's preparing for a bodybuilding competition where there's something to win, a pro card, a prize money, or for your sponsorship, where for half a day you need to look phenomenal. In that situation, it's useful. But for a recreational bodybuilder like myself or during the off season, it's absolutely not needed because there's much better drug selections out there, which will allow you to be in a perfect or a good state of health and a much better person mentally because it will. I barely know anybody that doesn't change mentally from this drug. Yeah.
Interesting. So what about, I think I've heard you mention primobolan. Primobolan, mm-hmm. is that an orally bioavailable?
Yeah, so that's also orally bioavailable. You have primobolan acetate tablets. They're FDA approved in Japan, I believe, from Bayer. I'm not really a big fan of orals that have an ester attached because they, you know, you take them orally and ideally you want a compound that doesn't have an ester because it doesn't have to be cleaved off by esterases. So most of the esterases that are in the body are not found in the intestinal tract. So a lot of it doesn't get absorbed properly. Mm. So I would always go with the primobolan enanthate, which you inject, And then the lipases and the esterases can start working on the the carrier oil and then get to the active pharmaceutical ingredient. Mm. So they cleave off the esterases, cleave off the ester, the enanthate from the primobolan over time. That allows for more stable serum concentrations, better bioavailability. So primobolan acetate tablets, I'm not really a big fan of. I never really recommend them. And I know a lot of women, they like to run primo acetate, but Anavar is much better, you know, on a milligram for milligram basis.
Is that because it doesn't have virilizing effects or anything? Or is it-
all androgens have virilizing effects. Right. And it's the same as with hair loss. You know, it just compounds over time. So, you know, they say nandrolone is reasonably hair safe. But I think still, if you are 20 years on nandrolone, you might still get some hair loss if you're prone to it. And if you're 20 years on Anavar, even though it's reasonably safe for women, even a low dose of 2.5 milligrams over 10 years, 20 years, it still compounds into virilization. It's just a slower effect. You know? So the overall androgen exposure really contributes to the side effects. So you have the dose and the duration of exposure. And for women, let's say, you know, you want to do contests, but you don't want to not do masculine classes like classic physique or a figure or that kind of those kind of classes. Mm. Let's say you do bikini or wellness. You want maybe low dose exposure for longer periods of time, only during contest prep when it's warranted to help with muscle preservation in a caloric deficit. But nowadays, all these girls run that year round. And then the first year in the contest, they look great. And then by the third year, the fifth year, they looked a little bit virilized. And that's almost irreversible. You know, I have a protocol to reverse it, but it depends on the severity, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. It's a little bit scary.
It is, yeah. Mm. Do you want to discuss a little bit about your experiments with the new up-and-coming anti-diabetic drug, liraglutide?
Yeah, sure. So there's, I started hearing about this through my wife's clients who are, you know, a little bit of they call it high so here in Thailand. You know, people that are well off, coming from a rich family, and they don't really understand about fitness, but they need the best trainer they could find. So they went with my wife because she's a 4-time world champion and she's had many competitions won, right? So they come to my wife with all these questions about fat burning drugs. So, and at one point, somebody mentioned something about Sazenda, which is liraglutide. It's a glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist. So let me explain how it works. When you eat food, your body releases two hormones, glucagon-like peptide 1 and gastric inhibitory polypeptide, which also has a different name. Now, they help with gastric emptying, control gastric juice, like the, you know, the digestive enzymes that are being secreted and stomach acid. So they help to control how you process the food. And the glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist helps with insulin and amylin secretion. Insulin helps to store the nutrients and manage glucose concentrations in the bloodstream. And the amylin helps to promote satiation further. So it's the glucagon-like peptide 1 that promotes satiation, gastric inhibitory polypeptide, and amylin. Now, when we take insulin, or diabetics take insulin, that entire ratio is thrown off. Mm. So the insulin concentrations are high and the amylin, GLP-1 and GIP concentrations are low. But if you take something that mimics this natural pathways of the incretins, it's a family of hormones, if you mimic this natural pathway, you promote satiation. So now you lower gastric emptying, you alter your stomach acid production, and you promote a little bit of insulin release and amylin release from the beta cells of the pancreas. So now you get satiation. So now you don't feel so hungry. Mm-hmm. So this is the only reason why I was able to do this fasting mimicking diet of eating vegetables only, because without the liraglutide, I'm you know, obscenely hungry. And by taking it, I have a meal and I'm satiated and I don't think about food. And you would think because it promotes insulin secretion, you would go hypoglycemic. But that's only at very high dosages where people start to abuse these compounds. So I stick with the lowest effective dose, which is less than what is prescribed typically for people with type 2 diabetes who basically gave themselves type 2 diabetes by overeating and poor diet practices, right? And then when you start doing the research, you'll see that liraglutide and some of the other GLP-1 receptor agonists are related to pancreatic cancer.
Right.
Right. But in people with type 2 diabetes who already had a poor diet model and probably continue to eat poorly. If you're adding either like a challenge, you know, I feel nauseous, but I'm still going to continue eating. So you keep forcing the pancreas. And the whole idea about taking insulin or GLP-1 in cases of type 2 diabetes is by taking pressure off the pancreas by not eating so much and supporting the pancreas, maybe with a basal insulin like Lantus or Epidra or something that acts longly. So the beta cells of the pancreas get some time off from producing all this insulin.
So does liraglutide, is that got a long half-life? Like, what's the administration?
So it has about 12-hour half-life.
Yep.
And there's several ones like dulaglutide or what is the other one called? Exenatide.
Yep.
Semaglutide, sorry. Dulaglutide and semaglutide have a very long half-life of about 4 days, 5 days, 7 days, depending on the compound. And then exenatide has a short-acting one and a long-acting one. And semaglutide is an oral version. So that has the same half-life as the injectable version, but you need to take it daily because it's a peptide. So you take it orally. Part of it probably breaks down. So it has poor bioavailability. But I believe they did something with it to increase the bioavailability. But then that compound that they added also created stomach ulcers or something like that. So there's always a trade-off with pharmacology.
So they're trying to modify the semaglutide to make it orally bioavailable.
I didn't really look deep into it because I tried dulaglutide and I became extremely nauseous for the first 2 days after administration. And then towards the end of the week, I start to get hungry again. So with the liraglutide, it allows for daily administrations. So let's say you do your dieting Monday to Saturday, and Sunday you have a refeed. Then Sunday you don't take it. So you don't feel nauseous. You don't get this appetite suppression. So it allows you to refeed some carbohydrates when you're doing a cyclic ketogenic diet, for example. So Monday to Saturday, I would dose like 0.6, maybe 1.2 milligrams of liraglutide in the morning, depending on how hungry I felt the day before. And that's more than enough to suppress my appetite. And then Sunday, I wouldn't take it. And I would go out and have a lunch and a dinner, you know, as part of my refeed / cheat meal day. So I could have some normalcy in my life. Because you can't stay inside eating all your own cooked food, right? You need to go out sometimes, especially during COVID.
Yeah, it's interesting going down that pathway to suppress appetite instead of abusing stimulants and other hardcore heavy hitting agents. What else have you used for appetite suppression?
Man, there's so much out there for appetite suppression and fat loss. Like you got Mega Hoodia that you can buy over the counter that works reasonably well. You need to dose that a few times per day, intermittently as required. Modafinil, has some appetite suppression and even a low dose of 50 milligrams per day. I don't understand how people can run 200. That's crazy. It's crazy to me, 50, 30 milligrams sometimes. It's more than enough. It helps to suppress appetite as well. Some of the other stimulants like phentermine, sibutramine, or there's another one. I can't remember. I tried it once and it felt like amphetamines, So there's many, many stimulant-based fat loss or appetite suppressants out there. Clenbuterol a little bit, ephedrine a little bit. Intermittent use of growth hormone because it raises glucose concentrations and triglyceride concentrations in the bloodstream. So you can use growth hormone as a fat loss aid or as a appetite suppressant because you're basically just dumping glucose and triglycerides from body fat stores, and the glycerol backbone from the body fat gets converted into glucose through gluconeogenesis in the liver. So you raise serum concentrations that way. So there's many, many methods to suppress appetite. Ketogenic diet suppresses appetite because you're in ketosis. Eating a whole bowl of vegetables suppresses appetite too, even though you don't get so many calories. So there's many, many methods to get that under control. Yeah.
Let's take a look at some of the WADA, the 2021 WADA prohibitive list. Like you did a really good video on that, guys. You have to check if you're listening in. You have to go check out.
Steve. You won't be able to pass the drug test. So I mentioned it in the video. So listen, just because they're not on the list or somewhat not prohibited, it doesn't mean you're going to pass the drug test. Because the problem with the WADA doping list is that they mention a lot of the compounds, but some of them not directly.
Yeah.
So DMAA, for example, when you go to Wikipedia and you see what dimethylamylamine stands for, you won't find it on the list, but it present on another name, 1,3-dehexa something. All right, so just because it's not on the list directly, it doesn't mean, it's not prohibited. So just a method of, to analyze, it's not found on the list, so you should be able to call yourself drug-free. You know, even though liraglutide and, you know, the dipeptidyl peptide S4 inhibitors are not found on the list, but you're certainly not drug free.
Yeah. Do you feel like they might be next year, like these compounds?
Or? After me announcing it on YouTube publicly, I'm sure they will be out there. Listen, I've helped so many people pass the drug test over the last 10 years because that's how I, started coaching, you know, help people beat the drug test.
Is that with like diuretics, masking agents, things like that? Or
No comment. some things it's better not to put publicly, you know. So there's masking methods to speed up the clearance, and then there's other ways around the test. It's many ways around the test. It's and part of that is figuring out the detection times and then making sure that, you know, they get excreted. And again, it's a drug test that shows that people compete in, not natural shows. So all you have to do is be drug-free on the day of the test. And whether that's a test 1 month before or a random drug test or in-competition drug test, all that matters is that you pass the drug test. Doesn't mean you're natural.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said they were natural, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
So it's... there's a lot of involved. Let's just put it that way.
Let's look at some of the recent findings from this Harleen study, because... Yeah, a lot of my listeners won't understand what post-cycle therapy is. So do you want to explain that first and then what the study maybe?
All right. So there's no consensus about how post-cycle therapy needs to be performed. So post-cycle therapy has been evolving over the last couple of years. So let's say you take steroids for X amount of years or maybe one cycle. You know, that's what people still like to do. You do one cycle, you go off, and you do post-cycle therapy to restore your natural testosterone production. A lot of people don't do their baseline testosterone check, so they have no idea where their testosterone needs to end up at after finishing post-cycle therapy. Mm. That's why I always recommend people say, hey, if you're drug-free and you're thinking about getting your hands dirty with anabolics or SARMs, do a baseline check to see where your testosterone is at. Mm. That's where you need to get it back to when you go off cycle. Now, if that's 10 years later, you do your one cycle and it's 10 years... Like I did three cycles. One was 16 weeks, the second one was 5 months, and the third one was 8 years. So I did three post-cycle therapies in my life, right? And I've helped many of my clients guide them through the process. And a lot has changed over the last 10 years as I did my research. So I did my baseline check at 26 years old. My testosterone was 650 nanograms per deciliter. Now, we didn't have the information about icing your balls or ashwagandha root extract or phosphatidylserine. You know, all that stuff was not available back then. So now it is, and now I'm incorporating some of those practices to get my testosterone back up. So 650 nanograms per deciliter 10 years ago, and now it's around 515 nanograms per deciliter. Well, before I started this fasting mimicking diet, that's a bit lower. So it's I would say that's a natural decline over 10 years. You know, it's still pretty good. Yeah, my father is a little bit lower. It was like 400, I can't remember. It was like somewhere in the middle of the reference range. So there's a good potential that I would be able to get my testosterone back. But some guys are, before they start their cycle, 200, maybe already subclinical, and then they try to get it back to 800. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Unless you were a really poor state of health before you started your cycle, but you should be in a good state of health before you start. I was in a good state of health.
It's the other way. It's often the other way around, right? The guys that jump on the gear, the ones that are in a shit state of health, right?
Yeah. It's like buying a sports car.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. You know, the hormone replacement community, they use it as a, you know, I'm in a poor state of health and, you know, I have my midlife crisis and I'm going to buy a sports car, or they go on hormone replacement. But why don't we try to optimize your health first? And then if it doesn't work, like all of my clients that are still drug-free that contact me for their first cycle, tell them, let's get your health under control. Focus on the micronutrients, you know, and then see if we can bring the testosterone up a little bit and improve your sex drive and anabolism and overall, sense of well-being. In some cases, it works. Some cases, it doesn't. Okay, then you have to look at hormone replacement. Mm. Now, you do hormone replacement for a certain period of time. Let's say you want to come off cycle to have kids, or you're bored of injecting, or you're tired of bodybuilding or pharmacology, whatever, or you have to, you know, resolve medical issues. You come off cycle. With the information that I have, I would recommend everybody to let all the androgens decline, their testosterone, their estrogen, and their progesterone. So the problem is, in that Harlem study, 50% of the people were on trenbolone, which is a 19-NOR derivative, which is detectable for up to 5 months.
Is that the most suppressive as well?
One of the most suppressive. Nandrolone is very suppressive, you know, like very suppressive. There's no gradation. Right. It either suppresses or doesn't. So if the metabolites or the compound itself is still in your system and it's agonizing the progesterone receptor in the hypothalamus and the pituitary, you forget about recovering. Mm. It doesn't matter if you block the estrogen receptor because the progesterone receptor is still being agonized. So you would need to take a selective progesterone receptor modulator, which have a lower binding affinity than trenbolone and nandrolone and mint and all the other 19-NORs. So it wouldn't even get to the receptor. Now, there's another compound called mifepristone, which blocks all the receptors, basically. So the estrogen, the androgen, and the progesterone and everything in between. Glucocorticoid also, you know.
Do you want to explain to my audience what that drug is? Because it's the morning after pill, right?
Yeah, it's a morning after pill, right? So it's a way to reduce, you know, pre-labor, too early premature labor.
Yeah.
It's a morning after pill. So it's a single dose or a double dose, and you know, that takes care of that basically. So bodybuilders have been using that to speed up, the rate at which the androgen receptor, progesterone receptor, and estrogen receptor are being antagonized with what is in the bloodstream. But the problem is, let's say you take trenbolone today and mifepristone tomorrow. Mifepristone is a half-life of 72 hours, 90 hours. So it metabolizes from your system. And then the trenbolone is like, thanks, buddy. Here I am again. And then you still have to wait. You know, like say you take trenbolone enanthate or parabolone with the super long half-life. And half-life later, maybe a month or 2 months later, trenbolone is still agonizing the progesterone receptor.
Wait, what's the half-life of trenbolone?
Enanthate is about 10 to 12 days. Acetate is about 3 to 5 days. And hexobenzyl cyclocarbonate, I think it was like 16 days.
Right.
Mm. So it has a very long half-life. And the injection depot, which carrier oil that you use plays a factor in that, how your lipases and esterases work, how your glucocorticoid system works, you know, allowing you to detox. So there's many different factors that contribute, you know, if you get hepatic recirculation. So that all contributes. So the half-life is just an indication. What I tell my clients and what I mentioned in the post-psychotherapy ebook, you stop injecting. If you took like 19-NORs, like trenbolone, nandrolone, or other compounds with a long half-life or progestogenic, you go on hormone replacement first until you feel normal. Maybe that's 6 months. If you really want to cough, you might want to take 6 months, wait 6 months, especially if you're on nandrolone with an 18-month detection time. Mm. So maybe at least 6 months you wait. And then you physically get used to true hormone replacement. So let's say your cycle was 1,000 milligrams. You tapered at 200 or 150 milligrams testosterone for 6 months. You get used to this, normal testosterone concentrations in the bloodstream. Then you stop that. And when you feel like a little girl, you know, all your hormones have declined. Right? You're subclinical on the testosterone, hopefully not the estrogen, because estrogen helps with luteinizing hormone receptor sensitivity and some of the signaling. I still can't find any data on how it actually increases the LACG receptor, but there is some data out there, but I can't for life of me figure out how that system works. So you don't want to crush your estrogen too low, but as long as your androgens are low and your progesterone or metabolites are low, you can block the estrogen receptor in the brain with selective estrogen receptor modulators like tamoxifen or clomiphene or enclomiphene or even raloxifene or tormifene, you know, whatever you have access to. I would, you know, with the data I have now, I would say Novodex and Clomid is pretty good. But if you can find enclomiphene, it's probably better than Clomid itself. Mm. because it has less of these estrogenic side effects in the brain and it's a little bit more selective. And then you ride that out for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, allowing your luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone to come back. And then testosterone, hopefully, not in all cases, but hopefully, is comparable to before your cycle, you know, or somewhere in the reference range. Now, that takes months. And most people, including that Harlem study, didn't undergo that correctly. But I understand there's no consensus on what how to do post-cycle therapy correctly. And it comes from experience, because nowadays, nobody does post-cycle therapy anymore. We do blasting and cruising. We do a cycle and then we go to hormone replacement. Then we do a cycle and we go to hormone replacement. And there's so many practices out there. Like you can keep your hypothalamic pituitary testes active, somewhat active with ACG or human menopausal gonadotropin or gonadorelin or gispeptin 10 or a low dose of enclomiphene to keep the LH and FSH production going, even though we'll still be at the bottom of the reference range.
There was one hormone that we sort of neglected, and that is prolactin. So I want to hear your stance there. Like, what can men do to modulate prolactin?
So prolactin is one of those hormones that releases in response to many different things: eating, mating, agonizing the progesterone receptor. Whether that's by taking pregnenolone, converting into progesterone, or taking 19-OR derivatives. Or maybe even synthetic progestins or estrogens, which are found in plastics. Right? That's also, you know, like phytochemicals. So there's, it can be caused by many different things, including pituitary adenomas. So if you see a prolactin, why is it always elevated? I'm doing everything I can to get it under control. Maybe it's time for an MRI. But then you would see other hormones elevated as well, like growth hormone, luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, everything else that comes out of the pituitary. You know, some of them will be elevated. So let's say you're perfectly healthy, but your prolactin is still high. Stop smoking weed. Stop taking kratom. Those drugs also elevate prolactin. So that's the first thing I ask. You know, I see the blood work. I ask them, smoking weed, taking kratom. Half of the time they say yes, take that out, problem solved.
Or SSRIs as well.
Yeah, but I don't see that much of the SSRIs blood work. Most guys that come to me, they're not on SSRIs.
Yeah.
So I don't see that so much. So I, you know, it could be a correlation, but I can't really say that. But it wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, if you know, if you're elevating your serotonin concentrations in the brain, I'm not. Is prolactin being released from serotonin?
So the theory is that serotonin can antagonize dopamine, and dopamine what drops the prolactin.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And then of course your dopaminergic drugs like modafinil, for example, it is able to, you know, erase dopamine concentration and have some serotonin-like effects. So I noticed that, you know, by taking modafinil, my prolactin is lower, but it's never out of range. It used to be out of range, but I was vitamin B6, B5B deficient.
Yeah.
So I was not able to produce enough dopamine. When I didn't know so much, I would take cabergoline to bring it down, which now I don't recommend to anybody anymore because of its, you know, list of side effects as well. This prolactin is also very complicated to, you know, there's so many compounding factors to help that get under control. And I know guys that are physically very active with the women and have high prolactin levels too. Yeah, just from that. And they take their vitamin B6 and maybe a modafinil to otherwise suppress that. But they're still physically active and the prolactin is top of the reference range.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Well, for my listeners, if they want to learn more about you, Steve, where can they? I know you mentioned some of your ebooks. I checked some of them out. They look really, really cool.
I have a couple of in-depth ebooks about bodybuilding pharmacology. You can find them on my website, vigorsteve.com/shop. I'm still in the process of writing a fat loss pharmacology handbook. It's taking way longer than I expected because, again, fat loss comes from so many different drugs and pathways, and you know, I extended that with keeping your appetite under control. So that's currently in the making. Hopefully it'll be released soon because it's been weeks now. But I have ebooks about how to do cycles with bioidentical hormones and get true full hormone replacement. So whether that's testosterone, neurosteroids like DHEA, pregnenolone, and optimize all the pathways that contribute to anabolism while keeping your health in mind. Detailed ebooks about how to use insulin, growth hormone, IGF-1, and how to do post-cycle therapy correctly. You can all find those on my website. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Steve. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know my listeners would have learned a lot from this episode.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no worries. We have a lot of, semi-professional athletes, not so much bodybuilders, but still there's a lot of those that want to dabble with, you know, some of these compounds. So guys, definitely get in touch with Steve. If you want to work with him, reach out, subscribe to him on YouTube. But otherwise, thanks for tuning in, everyone. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.